The final case for oral argument this morning is in the matter of the guardianship of SMN and others, and there are multiple parties in this case. For the appellant, Hughes County, we have Ms. Kelly Marnette, the Hughes County State's Attorney, is that correct? All right. And then Ms. Christina Klinger represents the mother. All right. And the grandmother is represented by Ms. Roseanne Wendell. And then the Appley children are represented by Mr. David Seabrass. Yes. My understanding is that Ms. Marnette will open with a 10-minute presentation, followed by Ms. Klinger for 10 minutes as appellants. And then as Appley's, Ms. Klinger will get 8 minutes, Ms. Wendell 8 minutes, and Mr. Seabrass 4 minutes. Then rebuttal will be 5 minutes for Ms. Marnette and 5 minutes for Ms. Klinger. So with that, if we get that accomplished, all will be well. The first 10 minutes will be Ms. Marnette's. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kelly Marnette. I represent Hughes County in this matter. The issue before the court is whether a circuit court has the authority to appoint an attorney at county expense to represent a parent in a guardianship proceeding where there's no involvement from the state and there's no request for termination of parental rights. It's the county's position is that there is no statutory authority and that there is no case authority to support that. In the court's decision, the court believes that there was some authority under the footnote in the THM case. It is the county's position that that footnote is applicable to that case only and does not give authority and is by no means a directive from this court that an attorney be appointed for all parents in guardianship proceedings.
Isn't there some inherent authority of a court to make sure that the parties are represented, especially minors?
Well, as far as the minors being represented, there is some statutory authority that in a guardianship proceeding, the court may appoint an attorney to represent the interests of the child. It's not mandatory as it would be in an abuse and neglect proceeding, but it is subject to the court's discretion. However, even that statute does not say who pays for that attorney, whether it's at public expense, at the county's expense, or whether it is somehow split up between the parties, whether that be a grandparent and a parent in the guardianship proceeding.
Is that the real issue in this that you're here for? Courts have a lot of authority to appoint an inherent authority, but isn't the real issue who pays?
Well, if the court is going to appoint an attorney, it's our position that it should not be at the county's expense because the county has no voice in this. It is not something that's brought by the Department of Social Services. It's not something that is brought by my office. As a matter of fact, I didn't know about this proceeding at all because I wouldn't have any involvement until the bill came.
Why would you care whether the court appointed an attorney or not as long as the county doesn't get the bill?
If the court wants to do something like that and the county doesn't get the bill, I wouldn't have any reason to object to it. I wouldn't have any standing to object to it. I wouldn't be a party to it. I wouldn't have knowledge of it. In this case, again, like I said, there is no state involvement. There was no request for termination of parental rights. If you look at the cases where this court and other courts have allowed attorneys to be appointed, they normally involve cases where someone's liberty is at issue. The exception to that has been in termination of parental rights cases where the courts have determined that those rights almost rise to the level of someone going to prison or to jail because of the fundamental right to the care, custody, and control of your children. But this case is really no different than two parents fighting over custody. There is no request by the state for termination. There's not going to be a deprivation of liberty. And therefore, the only issue is custody. And in that case...
But isn't the difference that the natural parent has a fundamental constitutional right to make decisions concerning the welfare of the child? That's the difference.
Well, I understand your point. There is a difference. However, this is a case of custody, not parental rights. And in custody cases all the time, you have parents who are unrepresented by attorneys who go in and fight over their fundamental right to have custody and control over their children. And courts every day make decisions that says one parent is going to have very limited visitation and one parent is going to have almost complete custody and control, depending on the circumstances. So courts do that in all kinds of cases, and the county is not made to pay for attorneys to represent parents when they're fighting over custody.
But here you've got, instead of just two parents, where it's only a best interest issue between two parents, here you have Troxell giving this fundamental constitutional right. It needs to be protected. Isn't that the difference?
Well, then what the court is saying is that the suggestion would be that all guardianship proceedings, when there's a parent involved, there would be an attorney represented or appointed to represent that parent at county expense. In that case, you could, in order to kind of dupe the system, you could have a grandparent come in and ask for a guardianship and have both parents fight each other in the guardianship, each receiving an attorney. I mean, in some ways, you could just bypass the whole thing, and all of a sudden, all parents in custody fights are having attorneys pay for at county expense.
Now, in your intervening pleadings, you are just contesting the attorney for the mother. You're not contesting the payment of attorney fees for the child?
We did not, because at least there was some statutory authority for the appointment itself. Also, at that point, the attorney bill for the child actually got through the system without even being caught, because it came in the interest of, and it was an attorney that had done several appointments where he had represented children, and that's how it went through. I'm not saying that the court shouldn't address that issue as far as who pays for that, but it is not an issue that the county has brought before this court. Obviously, any guidance the court would give would be appreciated in the future.
So this is a rather unusual case for Hughes County, actually getting a bill in a case like this.
It's very unusual. There are cases all the time in all the counties of this state that have cases where a grandparent or another relative or someone who's not even a relative applies through the guardianship statutes to have custody of a child. This is the first time that I personally have seen where the county received a bill for it. So if they've been done before, I don't have any knowledge of them. In my brief, I talked about the Lassiter factors. We talked about the factors that the court would need to consider when there's not a deprivation of physical liberty in determining whether an indigent litigant has the right to counsel. And as set forth in my brief, there's the personal interest at stake, there's the state's interest, and there's the risk that the procedure will lead to an erroneous decision. And as I set forth, the personal interest at stake, it is an important interest of the litigant. I have no doubt that this is a very important issue to the mother who lost custody in this matter. But when you look at what the state's interest in is, there was no state interest. We were not involved. It was not where the state had the ability to choose that this case was going to come forward or not come forward, as the state would have in any other case, where we would determine whether there should be an abuse and neglect proceeding, or we decide whether there should be a criminal matter or a juvenile matter pending. In this case, it's two private citizens that are having a fight and then asking Hughes County to pay for at least half of that dispute as far as attorney fees.
Are attorney's fees addressed at all in the guardianship? Can the court, is there a statute in the guardianship chapter that allows the court to order attorneys, one or the other, one of the parties to pay the attorney's fees of the other?
I guess I don't know the answer to that. All I can tell you is that the court has the ability to appoint the attorney, but that statute is silent on who actually pays for it.
You know, like in a divorce proceeding, the court has by statute, the authority to order one or the other party to pay attorney's fees.
Right. And I can't imagine that, you know, couldn't be done in this case.
Unless there's a statute that allows it. So that was my question. You're not aware one way or the other.
No. Going back to the Lassiter factors, again, the state's interest, there was no interest. But the final factor to look at is the risk that the procedure will lead to an erroneous decision. And I understand the mother's argument that she lost, therefore, you know, there obviously was a risk that there's an erroneous decision. However, these cases happen all the time, not necessarily within the bounds of a parent and a grandparent, but in the cases of parents fighting each other. There's always going to be a risk, but we do not allow the county to pay the cost of attorneys to be appointed for parents in a custody fight just based upon the risk that there could be an erroneous decision. The issues in this case, although they are somewhat complex with the new laws that have been passed, however, they're not that much more difficult than in a regular custody dispute. I see my time is about up. For any issues that I was not able to address personally with you today, I would rely on my brief, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Barnett. Ms. Klinger, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Justice Gilbertson. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Christy Klinger, and I was appointed to represent the mother at the trial court level. The first issue that needs to be addressed is whether the trial court's decision to allow this matter to proceed under the Timmy's laws and the Guardianship Act was clearly erroneous. This court said in THM that when a petition is based off of abuse and neglect, the SDCL 26-7A and 28 is the exclusive jurisdiction for that petition. For that reason, the trial court's decision to allow this to proceed under Timmy's laws and in the Guardianship Act was clearly erroneous. This court was clear in THM that when abuse and neglect is the primary basis for any petition, especially with regard to a non-parent seeking custody over a parent, the abuse and neglect statutes, which offer constitutional protections necessary to protect a parent's fundamental right to the care, custody, and control of their children, is the appropriate standard.
All right. The initial petition alleged abuse and neglect as the grounds, correct?
Yes.
Was that ever amended?
No. There was never any amendment to the petition, even after this issue was brought up in front of the trial court. The temporary order that was granted by the trial court specifically stated that the reasons that the temporary guardianship was being granted was based on abuse and neglect issues.
And at the end, there was no motion to conform to pleadings or anything of that nature in this case. Is that what you're saying?
No, Justice, there was not. THM controls this matter, even though the Timmy's laws were adopted after THM. Timmy's laws created an avenue for a non-parent to gain custody of a child through the Guardianship Act. Timmy's laws did not overrule this court's decision in THM. This court's decision that the exclusive jurisdiction for abuse and neglect proceedings lies within SDCL 26-8A remains good law today. And for that reason, the trial court was clearly erroneous in making this decision to proceed under Timmy laws, especially when the petitioner's petition did not properly assert the Timmy laws or the Guardianship Act. What was set forth in the petitioner's petition was abuse and neglect allegations.
Was that objection made at the time during the trial? Did you make that objection to the trial lawyer or the trial court at the time?
Yes, we had a significant hearing. I believe it was on May 2nd.
So it wasn't tried under that by agreement or okay.
No, it was not. We had a fairly lengthy. We had a lot of hearings in this, as there was almost everything was contested. But that was an issue brought up to the trial court, and the trial court made the decision and did rule that this should proceed under Timmy's laws, and the Guardianship Act rather than abuse and neglect statutes.
You're not alleging, are you, that the Timmy's Law is unconstitutional?
No, I am not. I am. My position is that because it was abuse and neglect allegations that this petition was based off of, this is in the wrong arena. It should be within DSS's discretion and Hughes County's discretion to file these charges. Neither of those agencies decided to file charges, yet the petitioner and the non-parent was allowed to choose its avenue and choose the statutory framework in which it wanted to proceed and, in essence, avoid the laws that are actually controlling in this circumstance.
So you're saying that authority to bring in abuse and neglect is exclusive to the state and that there is no private cause of action for somebody who's a relative?
Yes. I think that the cause of action for the relative would be to report that to DSS or to the state and then allow that agency to proceed with their investigation.
But isn't this case just like THM in that DSS in both cases, your case and THM, declined to do anything?
DSS did decline to do anything in this case because all of the allegations made within the petition, all but one, were over 2 years old. They were extremely old allegations, and the fact that DSS and Hughes County failed to do anything with regard to file any actions it foreshadows what actually should have been done in this case. The non-parent should not be allowed to choose a different statutory framework in order to avoid the very agencies charged with determining whether
but
there's
if these agencies declined to, for whatever reason, they declined to get involved in the case. Are you saying then that a grandparent who feels that the children are in extraordinary circumstances and need help has no recourse then? They can't use Timmy's Law?
They can use Timmy's Law without asserting abuse and neglect. The petition in this case was primarily based on abuse and neglect, as was shown in the temporary order that was entered by the trial court.
But did the court enter any, did the court enter any other findings in addition to any? Well, first of all, did the court find there was abuse and neglect? And secondly, did the court find extraordinary circumstances as per Timmy's Law?
The final decision did find extraordinary circumstances, which we also believe was clearly erroneous. They did. In THM.
But the trial court did not find abuse and neglect.
They did not.
Yeah.
And which is a very important aspect here. The pleadings by the petitioner never pled anything remotely close to getting under the Timmy's Laws or the Guardianship Act. So to allow this to proceed without any amended pleadings or any motion to amend the pleadings after the trial court had been held for 3 days, it was clearly erroneous decision by the trial court.
But did the trial? But during the trial, did the issue of extraordinary circumstances come up so that you had noticed that they were seeking to be covered by Timmy's Law?
Yes, the trial court addressed this in a separate hearing, and his ruling. The court's ruling was that it would proceed under Timmy's Law and extraordinary circumstance, which is a part of that. But in 26.8.8, a parent is offered, a parent has the constitutional protections of reasonable efforts to return the children to the home. The parent also has least restrictive alternative. That was not ever offered to this mother. The mother had the children every other week during the summer. No detriment came to the children. No harm came to the children. There was nothing that ever showed that anything was wrong with this mother's care. At the request of one of the attorneys involved, the Sioux Falls Police Department, which is where the mother lives, did an unannounced welfare check at the mother's apartment. Detective Bakke with the Sioux Falls Police noted that there was no problems. There was no indication that anybody but the mother and the children were living at the home. He spoke with the children on their own. There was never any, he did not believe there was any indication of any type of abuse or that these children were in harm's way. In fact, the detective didn't even see a reason to go back or talk.
You are kind of touching on it, but I'd like it if you would, you only have a short time left. You mentioned that you said the trial court was clearly erroneous in finding that Timmy's Law was met here, and I'd like you to address that if you would.
The trial court found that the mother abdicated her parental rights, which it was clearly erroneous. Abdication in and of itself means a formal relinquishment of the rights and responsibilities. In this case, Respondents Exhibit 1, mother specifically went through the trouble of writing out an agreement to give to the non-parent to make sure this was a temporary situation. Mother was trying to get away from an abusive relationship, and she did not want to take her children to Sioux Falls without having a stable environment. She asked for help from a non-parent. If we start to tell parents who are in a troubling situation where they have to decide whether to take their children or leave them with a non-parent and come back later, we start to tell them that they're never going to get their children back or that the care, custody, and control is going to be permanently taken away from them, we're going to have parents, single parents, who simply don't ask for help, and children are going to be put in much less situations. So there was absolutely no abdication of rights by this mother. She had contact. She saw the children in every month but November. She had contact with the non-parent regarding school. The abdication was clearly erroneous. With regard to the extraordinary circumstances, that was also not here. The mother left for eight months, only four of which were voluntary. So in case law, is very clear that up to 7 years later, this court has given children back to their parents. And I see that my time has run out.
Your time has run out as the appellant. Now the clerk can reset the clock for 8 minutes, and you now are the appellee.
I will try to stay on point and not digress back to the arguments that I didn't make. I was appointed to represent the mother in this case. I don't think we need to get to whether or not a mother or a parent is entitled to representation in the Timmy's Law and Guardianship Act. There's only one equitable result here. I was appointed as of effective May 2nd to represent this mother. I and my firm did so with the expectation that we would get paid at the court-appointed rate. We completed the work, and then all of a sudden now we're not getting paid. There's only one equitable result here. We can't have private appointed attorneys be told after the work is done, after a three-day trial, after three hearings, three motions hearings, which were 1 to 3 hours, after the interviews that were completed. This was a very lengthy case. To tell an attorney afterwards, you're not getting paid, even though the trial court appointed you, it results in an inequitable result.
You keep talking equity, but don't you really have to focus on whether there's a statutory authority where the legislature authorizes or mandates Hughes County to pay your bill?
And I believe we do have that statute, but the trial court has authority and even inherent authority under such an issue that involves the fundamental rights to the care, custody, and control of the children to appoint me. Under 716A12, a trial court can appoint a private attorney when the public defender is conflicted out. On page 25 of the May 2nd hearing, there was a conversation started about appointing attorneys. The public defender was contracted out, which is why the children's attorney is not a public defender. The children's attorney was appointed first. So under 1716A, the court does have authority to appoint a private attorney and to appoint me in this situation. And because the trial court did appoint me, the trial court's order should stand. There was not an abuse of discretion involved. Also, under 25.529, this court, by the legislature, this court was given the authority to afford a parent with any constitutional rights that this court or the United States Supreme Court deems appropriate. Because this is such a fundamental right, one that exercises or that extends back to the beginning of our country, I do believe that a court-appointed attorney is appropriate under the Due Process Clause, and 25.529 gives this court the statutory authority that it needs to uphold the trial court's decision.
Is there any authority for the court to require the people or whoever is seeking the guardianship to pay for the mother's attorney?
I am not aware specifically, but 29A5 does relate back to 25.5, which is the custody statutes. Custody statutes do allow for fees to be paid by parties. So while I did not address that question, so I'm not specifically, I am pretty sure that it could be done. Yes. In addition, the county has focused on the Latsier decision. Our position is Gagnon, which v. Scarpelli is actually what's applicable here. Gagnon stated, and Eldridge actually quoted, that the decision whether to appoint a court-appointed attorney in a civil action remains within the sound discretion of the trial court. The Eldridge factors were a guidance, but they were not a requirement. And since they were not a requirement, there's no abuse of discretion at the trial court level by appointing me. Even if we do consider the Eldridge factors, the result is still the same. If we take into consideration the mother's interest here, it's certainly the care, custody, and control over children is certainly more than a civil forfeiture action, as was in State v. $1,010. In that case, a court-appointed attorney was allowed. Mother's interest here is certainly more than that. There's no authority that there has to be a termination of a parental rights in order to fall within the strongest compelling issue for the parent. The fundamental right is the care, control, and custody of the children, and that's exactly what was taken here under the guardianship and Timmy laws. So mother's interest is a commanding one. It's one of the strongest. Some people consider it to be the care, custody, and control of their children to be more important than their personal freedom. So mother's interest under the Eldridge factors is at its strongest. The state, if I understood the argument correctly, now says that they have no interest in this case. So in order to meet their requirements under the second Eldridge factor, that's a zero for the state. At most, it's a monetary figure. Monetary can in no way supersede or go above the mother's fundamental rights here. And then with the risk to an erroneous decision, we claim that even with a court-appointed attorney, there was an erroneous decision. We have four attorneys here when we're at the Supreme Court arguing over this. There was no way the mother who had a GED could have presented her case here. We had a custody evaluator. We had a counselor who was not qualified but was very difficult to deal with, would not provide records without argument. We had evidentiary rulings. We had issues over the Timmy laws. There was a question as to the constitutionality of the Timmy laws at first. The mother with a GED in no way could have provided this. So out of all three of the factors, they lean towards a court-appointed attorney.
But what state action is involved here?
I'm sorry?
But what state action is involved here?
Because the court did not allow this to proceed under the abuse and neglect, I don't know that there is a state action involved. But under Gagnon, you do not have to have state involvement in order to have a court-appointed attorney. You can appoint it in a civil case. And that's left to the sound discretion of the trial court as to whether the rights presented in the civil case are prevalent enough to appoint an attorney. This is the mother has a very fundamental right, a very basic right that's been recognized since the beginning of our country. That's what deserves a court-appointed attorney here. That's what deserves the county to pay for this court-appointed attorney. They have a right to protect or to make sure that all of the cases are completed appropriately. And the mother here has a fundamental right that should be protected. There was no abuse of discretion.
All right. At the appointment, there's statutory references and inherent authority of the court, but I'm still coming back to the issue of what obligates the county to pay.
And my time's out. May I answer?
Let me answer.
public policy obligates the county to pay. We have such a fundamental right here with the mother that it's been recognized several times by this court, by the Supreme Court, and then all of a sudden the mother, who, if she was not indigent, probably would not even be in this circumstance. Somebody with more money probably doesn't ever come within this situation. So the public policy and is what dictates the state's or the county's obligation to pay to assure that fundamental rights are protected and adhered to.
Okay, your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Wendell, you have 8 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I would just like to address some of the issues that Ms. Klinger addressed in her appellant's argument. First of all, I would disagree with her that THM was not overruled by the Timmies laws, including the Meldrum v. Novotny case. And clearly, when Timmies laws were codified, there's direct and specific issues related to abuse and neglect that are addressed in the Timmies laws as authority for non-parents to come into court and say these issues are present in this case, and I believe it's in these kids' best interest for me rather than the parent to have custody. Specifically under 25.529, the first section says that the parent has abandoned or persistently neglected the child. And then under 25.530, which addresses the extraordinary circumstances, it says they are circumstances suggesting serious detriment to the child. If that isn't issues somehow related to abuse and neglect, not that they necessarily would meet the statutory definition by the Department of Social Services for abuse and neglect, but certainly there are issues that lean in that direction. And then there's 10 things listed, 9 specific, and then a catch-all section, and many of those also address issues that are directly related to abuse or neglect of a child. Like number one is the likelihood of serious physical or emotional harm to the child if placed in the parent's custody. And if that isn't something that's directly related to abuse and neglect, I don't know how much more clear the legislature could have been in permitting and overturning THM and permitting a non-parent to pursue custody when there are concerns about abuse and neglect. I would add, too, that the petition, which was filed by grandmother, did address other issues, you know, besides those related to abuse and neglect. There were all kinds of issues that had occurred over a long period of time that did involve, to some extent, abuse and neglect, and then some that did not. But basically, the argument here is that, you know, is it going to be our public policy for grandparents or other interested parties to stand back and permit abuse and neglect to occur, let the Department of Social Services get involved, and then hope for the best as far as whether those kids can stay with family members or be placed other places? That it's in the Meldrum v. Novotny case directly addressed, you know, how while parents' rights have always been recognized, and they are strong rights, and they should be, but children's rights are also an issue, and these kids have a right to be in a safe environment, and that's why when looking at what's in these kids' best interests, we look at things other than are these parents fit, or, you know, the issues that were looked at prior to the Timmies laws.
So, in the abuse and neglect statutes, though, there's a whole scheme of what the state has to do before they can take them away. What they have to do to try to reunite. It's got to be the least restrictive. None of that was addressed by your clients or any of the parties, nor the judge. Isn't that correct? So how you're just picking and choosing parts of the abuse and neglect? I mean, explain that. How do you get to do that?
I don't think the abuse and neglect statutes apply here at all because...
So then should it have been dismissed, as they suggest?
No, it should not have been, because the state did not become involved, and where termination of parental rights is an issue if that's the least restrictive alternative, the state did not become involved, and because of that, all of the things that you're talking about aren't at issue. In this case, what we're talking about is a grandmother who was forever in these children's case a safety net. Abuse and neglect didn't happen because she was there buying food, housing them, clothing them, feeding them, And she acted as a safety net for these kids rather than stand back, let abuse and neglect happen, and hope that the Department of Social Services intervened before something happened to these kids. I think the Timmy's laws are very clear that that's why it's permitted for a non-parent to intervene in children's lives who cannot protect themselves and say, I'm not going to stand back and let this happen.
Well, I don't think that's the argument. I think the argument, though, is which procedure needs to be followed. Is it a state action under the abuse and neglect, or can a private citizen bring that?
Well, a private citizen cannot bring an abuse and neglect action.
Isn't that what was pled in this case?
No. In this case, it was a guardianship petition.
But the basis of the guardianship was abuse and neglect.
To some extent.
Or isn't that what was pled?
Okay, not completely. No. There, in the petition, there were some issues that related to abuse and neglect. But that's permitted under 29A5106(1), who says that states that we should look at the guardianship in conjunction with the Timmy's laws, and it's permitted under the Timmy's laws to assert that there's abuse and neglect going on. It's clearly in the.
The court did not make a finding that this parent was unfit, did it?
That's correct, and that's not necessary under the Timmy's laws.
How do you deal with the United States Supreme Court case of Troxell that custody is a fundamental right of the parents, and that wasn't addressed in this case?
Well, I think it was addressed, Justice. It is a fundamental right, but as was stated in Meldrum v. Novotny, those fundamental rights that parents have inherently come along with responsibilities, and if they're abdicating those responsibilities, they're also going to abdicate some of their rights. And that's exactly where these Timmy's laws came about. If a parent isn't going to do what they need to do to protect children, then this legislature has said a non-parent can step in
Well, did the court address the presumption that goes along with a parent having rights?
Yes.
Did they deal specifically and make findings on the presumption of parents having custody of their children?
I believe that Justice. I'm looking for them right now, but I do believe that that was an issue, if not in the final findings of fact in one of the previous hearings. Clearly, this court, the trial court, understood the standpoint from which we started. And in his oral findings, you know, he said, I'm not finding that this is an unfit mother. However, the inquiry does not stop there.
Did you ever plead the elements of Timmy's law, that's the procedure that you were proceeding?
In a hearing previous to the final guardianship trial, that issue was addressed, and the trial court found that Timmy's laws, because of 29A5106.1, were going to be considered in conjunction with the guardianship statutes, which I think statutorily, I think that's clear that those two should be heard together. My time is up, unless you have other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wendell. Mr. Seabrass, you're going to have to talk fast. You got 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court and counsel, with respect to a couple issues I've heard to this point, I have somewhat of an advantage going forth in this process. With respect to the issue of notice and whether it was pled out in the guardianship petition, no, it was not initially pled out in the guardianship petition about the Timmy's laws. However, if you look back in the record, I was appointed on May 2nd, 2008. That'd be settled record 50. On May 15th, 2008, I made a motion for a custody evaluator. That's settled record 65. On May 19th, the court held a hearing on that motion, among other motions. There was a order proposed, and that order, which includes the criteria of Timmy's laws, in addition to the guardianship best interest criteria, were all contained within the order for the custody evaluator within settled record 111. Ms. Klinger received that pursuant to a notice of entry of order on settled record 113, And then she also filed her objections to the proposed order, and those will be filed at Settled Record 118. I submit to the court that by consent, because of the procedural way that the order for custody evaluator took place and the inclusion of the Timmy's laws as the criteria that the custody evaluator would be evaluating things and did present testimony on that at the trial in August of 2008, that it was tried by consent of Ms. Klinger. She objected vehemently. She had plenty of notice, and she presented evidence contrary to it. She cross-examined Ms. Zimbelman on those criteria, and those are set forth within her brief. So I submit to the court that there was no issue of improper notice about that issue, that we were proceeding under both guardianship and the Timmy's laws at the trial in August of 2008. With respect to some of the other items that have come up, I believe that the court needs to try and come up with the how this procedurally came about. The THM case was decided in late January 2002. Timmy's laws were passed by the legislature on an emergency basis at the end of February 2002. I submit in direct response to the court's rulings in the THM case, but also Melvin v. Novotny case, which is 2002, South Dakota 15. That was decided and opinion released on the same day as the THM case. So I submit that the legislature responded to the court's determination that a grandparent could not proceed under the abuse neglect theories in a private action not involving the state. And their response was to establish the Timmy's laws. And I submit to you that they are consistent with the case that I would submit is the basics of a non-parent seeking custody, which is the guardianship of Settlemyer, which is 491 Northwest 2nd 86, decided in 1992 by this court. That set forth the presumption that it's in the best interest of the children to be with the parent, but then also imposed the burden on the party attacking that.
Is the best interest presumption the same as determining whether or not the parent is fit, which Troxell talks about?
I submit that they're separate. It's merely a procedural matter that the opposing party has to overcome, and then the Troxell decision goes on and puts forth specific areas that must be proven to overcome that presumption. And those within Settlemyer,
it's presumed they're fit, and that if they're fit, they make the right decision in regard to what's in the interests of their children.
That's the presumption that can be rebutted.
Right.
Yes.
Was there a determination, however, of fitness in this case?
In this case, I believe the court did make the determination that there was fitness, but I believe that both the Settlemyer case and the Timmy's laws go on to name criteria in which.
So the fitness then doesn't mean any. You're saying you just write that out of Troxell, that we don't need to make that determination, or we can say it's the parent is fit and still give the custody to somebody else?
I submit that's possible because
under
of the
Constitution?
I submit, yes, Your Honor, because there's other issues such as abandonment, a forfeiture of your parental rights, your legal surrender of your rights. Unfitness is only one of the categories.
None of that is here, though. None of those issues are part of this, are they?
I submit that they are because of the facts of this case.
Did the trial court determine that?
I believe in findings of fact or conclusions of law that they did. The conclusions of law, I think.
There was certainly not a voluntary termination.
There was no termination of parental rights in this. It was only
a
placement.
Nor was there a voluntary giving up the rights to have your custody of your children.
I would submit that by her actions, she established either abandonment or persistent neglect or forfeiture of her rights. When she moved to Sioux Falls in August of 2007, and did not seek custody back until March of 2008. So I submit that those exist. If the court would look at findings of fact 6, it goes through some extraordinary circumstances. There'll be conclusions of law 6. And then there's some findings of fact 5, 6, and 7 of the courts to deal with some of the constitutional issues with regard to that. I'm out of time.
Out of time about 3 minutes.
I'm sorry, Your Honors.
Courtesy of Justice Mary Henry, you got in a few more licks.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. Okay, now we'll go to the rebuttals. Ms. Marinette, you have 5 minutes, and this is on the attorney fee issue.
I'll let Mr. Seabrass have my time, a little of my time, and I'll make this short. I just want to address briefly two things. First of all, the equitable issue. I understand Ms. Klinger's concern. She put in a lot of time on this case. And as being a prior attorney that was in private practice, I know how it is to put in a lot of time and not be paid for what you did. However, the question is, should Hughes County be the one that pays the money when the court, I believe, has had no authority to appoint the attorney at county expense for it? So does the county pay for that mistake, or does the attorney pay for that mistake, or does somehow the court pay for it? I don't know who pays for it, but I don't believe that it's any more equitable to pay Ms. Klinger than it is compared to having, you know, the county have to pay that expense.
So the basis for the payment is an order by the court.
Right. And okay. And when I found out about it, it was objected to. Obviously, had I known about this case when it was going on, I would have checked with the Department of Social Services to see if I should be filing an abuse and neglect proceeding. But I was not aware of it, and I want to make sure that the court understands it is not the fault of my office that there was not anything done with regard to any abuse or neglect that was happening in that home.
Can we say that in some sense there was a state action, though, in the sense that the legislature has created a Timmy's Law, which basically gives anybody in the world the right to come to court and take my children away from me and deny me a fundamental right to my children. So isn't that a state action that might justify a court in saying, well, the parent has to have an attorney and the only available payment authority is the county?
If that is what the court decides to do, then I would submit that the county or the state must be a party to the action and be present and involved in it to make sure that as far as who gets appointed would be complied with. The county has a set procedure as far as appointing attorneys and or, you know, deciding who's going to take what cases. And obviously the state's in the courtroom during these proceedings to make sure that the set upon procedures are followed. In this case, they weren't followed is what I submit. There is really no record on it, but obviously without being in the courtroom to say, well, no, this person is under contract with the county, I mean, it all happened without any knowledge by my office. Secondly, I'd like to talk about is Ms. Klinger's talked about, you know, the state protecting people's rights, and there's a point that can go too far. The state, you know, one small state's attorney's office cannot possibly be involved in every custody fight, in every guardianship, in order to make sure that a parent's fundamental rights to custody are taken care of. Otherwise, my office would be a party to every case that involves custody of a child that happens in this county. And although there's a fundamental right to custody, unless there is some state action, we are involved and we are seeking termination of parental rights, a permanent end to the custody, care, and control of that child. The county cannot be part of the action and cannot be made to pay for the action. I'm leaving the rest of my time.
Can I ask you one question? Is there a legal aid, is there a branch of legal aid that would have been available for this?
There are. County? Yes, there is. There's peer area referral. There's also East River Legal Services, I think, covers things just on the side of the river. But so those options are available to both parents in guardianship proceedings and also parents in custody disputes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Marnette. And then we will hear from Ms. Klinger for 5 minutes.
I will try to keep my remarks not commenting on Ms. Marnette's last argument and solely to Mr. Seabrass and Ms. Wendell's. 29A5106 provides that if there's any inconsistencies with the Guardianship Act, the Timmy Laws, or any other chapters, including 268A, then the other chapter, 268A, takes precedence and 29A5 becomes supplemental. In this case, the matter at hand, 29A5, the Guardianship Act, and the Abuse and Neglect Statutes were inconsistent. Abuse and neglect statutes allow for the least restrictive alternative. They allow for reasonable efforts to return the children to the parents. The Guardianship Act and the Timmy Laws did not provide for that. Since there is an inconsistency, 26-8A controls the situation, and this should have been an abuse and neglect case.
It never would have been one, though. I mean, we're kind of in a dilemma here because it was never going to be an abuse and neglect case, was it? The DSS refused to act.
There wasn't going to be an abuse and neglect case, and as DSS even the summer of 2008 again showed, they've talked to mother. They've talked to these kids. They've interviewed them significantly. DSS didn't just kind of blow off their job here. There was no reason for an abuse and neglect case here. There was nothing that supported that these children were abused and neglected. So for that reasoning, no, there wouldn't have been an abuse and neglect. But instead, a non-parent was allowed to kind of skirt tail around that and still retain custody of another's child. So yes, that's correct, Justice Konenkamp, that there would not have been an abuse and neglect proceeding. But that's part of the reasoning here is there should not have been. These children should have been returned to mother. There was an agreement in place. Mother didn't just walk away from these children. She didn't abandon them. The case law is very clear. In order to abandon a child, there has to be intent. Everything about what mother did here was the very opposite. She wrote an agreement. She signed an agreement, and she took care to make sure that agreement wasn't signed in front of her employer, Jason Dotson, who had nothing to gain by this action. Mr. Dotson testified that the non-parent and the mother agreed in front of him this was a temporary situation and that the children would go back to the mother at any time. The fact that grandma then decided to change her mind cannot be used against the mother. There was no abandonment. The trial court didn't find any abandonment. The trial court found extraordinary circumstances which would result in a serious detriment to the children.
Well, what did the trial court mean by abdication?
A formal relinquishment. We had testimony from Ms. Zimbalin on that, what it actually means. And it's a formal relinquishment of a right. That was not done here. Even Ms. Zimbalin stated, after thinking about it, that was not done by the mother. The mother had contact with these children. She called, and she had every other week visitation for a full week during the summer of 2008 with these children. She did not abdicate any rights. I understand Mr. Seabrass's argument that the Timmy laws and guardianship laws were brought to my attention. They absolutely were. I was very adamant that it was inappropriate at the trial level, and I'm very adamant about that now. There was never any consent on behalf of mother to have this tried under the Timmy laws, but the trial court ordered it, and we had to go along with it. There was never any consent. Mr. Seabrass relied on Ms. Zimbalin's report, which the trial court didn't even find reliable enough to cite in its decision. Ms. Zimbalin's report in this case was not adequate. It was unreliable. And, frankly, it relied on the wrong interests. The very first paragraph of her report states, she is determining what is in the best psychological interest of these kids. That's the wrong standard. The standard is whether the mother was fit. The trial court determined that she was not, and so it should end there. Even if we get into
the determined that she was fit.
That she was fit.
Right, okay.
Excuse me, thank you. Even if we get into the extraordinary circumstances.
So in your interpretation of that, once the trial court determines she's fit, it ends.
Yes.
Nothing can then trump that, or there can't be other evidence of these other Timmy factors that would overcome the fitness finding.
Correct. It's her fundamental right that she remains fit, and it's assumed that she's providing the best interest of these children is done since she's determined to be fit.
Well, under Meldrum versus Novotny, there was never a finding of unfitness of the natural father there. In fact, he was a pretty good guy.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe the court then went on to determine extraordinary circumstances, which I understand that was the court's decision at that point. Here, there's no extraordinary circumstances or serious detriment, as was shown by the mother having these children every other week during the summer of 2008, DSS and Detective Bakke of Sioux Falls Department allowing these children to stay without so much as a parental class.
Thank you. Your time has expired. We'll be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.